Really enjoyed the evening last night, and we missed the first evening. We were traveling home from Belize, and just really had a good week. I think I'd said something before we left that we had not been down there for about 11 years, and so our week was spent kind of rekindling some old friendships, and I had a chance to meet a lot of my former students after being after teaching down there. It was kind of bittersweet in some ways, walking into school and everyone's moved on since I was there. But yeah, encountered some former students. That was good. Enjoyed seeing Galen, seeing Myra from here, from church. And also really enjoyed taking our oldest daughters around to show them the old haunts and show Shakira where she was born. That was a good time. It was nice and warm. Had fresh pineapple, fresh bananas. A lot of good things, a lot of good food. So we had a really good week. And but it was sad to miss the other night. I did have a chance to go back and listen to that today. But I was challenged last night in just story, the power of story. I think it was about 15 years ago, this was while we were in Belize. We actually had come home one summer, and I went out to Faith Builders for Teachers Week. And I still have never forgot one of the talks. I think of that whole time I was there, there's one talk that made the biggest impression on me. And I think part of it was maybe because of its simplicity. And the title of the talk was Traits of Terrific Teachers. And, you know, one thing it did not include was, as a teacher, the importance of being prompt or how long you should prep or study. But it was only two traits that the speaker talked about, and I've never forgotten them. And the first trait of a terrific teacher, and he modeled this after Jesus himself. The first trait is that good, terrific teachers ask questions. And Jesus was a master of asking the right questions. And I didn't spend a lot of time doing research on this, but I understand that in Judaism, questions are very important. In fact, one thing that was referenced as I was looking into this was you look in the Old Testament. Notice how many times in the Old Testament a phrase would be brought up, something to the effect of, you know, when your children or when your son asks you, or when your children ask you, then you tell them, you know, it was about a memorial or something like that. And so I believe in Judaism, questions are important. And sometimes a question is answered by a question. And it's how you learn. And I heard a story one time about a man who was talking to a Jew, and he was a little frustrated with the Jew because every time you'd ask a Jew a question, he would always answer with another question. And so he was a bit frustrated, and he asked this Jew, he said, "Why do you always answer questions with a question?" And the Jew thought a bit, and his reply was, "What's wrong with asking questions?" So ask questions causes us to learn, and I think a good teacher does that. They ask the right questions, and I thought of the story of the Good Samaritan. And a man comes to Jesus and asks him a question. He says, there's actually a lawyer, came up, and instead he tempted him, trying to trick Jesus. He asked the question, "Master, what shall I do to inherit eternal life?" And Jesus, like a good Jew, answered with a question. He said, "What is written in the law? How readest thou?" And of course, the lawyer goes on to recite the great commandment. And Jesus answered and says, "You have answered right. This do and thou shalt live, because you were supposed to love your neighbor as yourself." But he, willing to justify himself, said unto Jesus, "And who is my neighbor?" And then Jesus launches into a story. The second trait of a terrific teacher is good teachers tell stories. And we've been hearing that the last couple of evenings. Again, Jesus did most of his teaching. A large majority of his teaching was done through stories. And in a wonderful story, as the lawyer asked Jesus, "Who is my neighbor?" Jesus launches into a story. And you notice throughout the story, Jesus brings some other truths into the story that really were not pertaining to the original question. The question was, "Who is my neighbor?" And so Jesus illustrates the story by having a traveler is attacked by thieves and left to die wounded on the road. And along comes a priest, a religious man, and he passes by. And then a Levite comes, and he passes by. And so woven into this story, Jesus illustrates several other truths. And one of those truths is that religion by itself without action is really worthless. And he uses the character of a priest and a Levite. characters that the crowd could understand who they were and who they represented. And so Jesus in the background is portraying that sometimes religion on the outside really is not being worked out in everyday living. And then he does something that's really remarkable in this story. And the hero of the story comes along, and he's a Samaritan. And today, we know of the term Samaritan, I think, because of this story. You've heard of Samaritan's Purse. That's an organization that does all kinds of good. In this area, we have the Samaritan medical helicopters go to accidents. But the term Samaritan in that day was that person was not a good person necessarily, not one who was looked up to, but was reviled in culture. And it was the unexpected person who Jesus weaves into the story as the rescuer. So throughout the story, all these different subplots are happening, and these truths are being proclaimed. And then in the end, when he comes to the end of the story, and the Good Samaritan pays the debt and takes care of the wounded man, Jesus again ends with a question. And he asks the man, "Which now of these three thinkest thou was neighbor unto him that fell among the thieves?" And the man answered, "The one that showed mercy." And Jesus says, "You go do the same." And I thought of that tactic that Jesus used, or that method of teaching, asking questions, telling stories. And if you have been a teacher or if you're a parent, you know, sometimes people come and they ask you a question of, you know, something they want to do. Can I do this? You know, and sometimes when we just give an answer, you know, the thing about just giving an answer is our children like to say, well, either I can either accept the answer or I can reject it, and I can do whatever with the answer I want. But when you turn around and you ask the question, well, what do you think would be the right thing? Then somehow there's a personal ownership that has to happen and a commitment. And Jesus did that with his man. He put the scenario in front of him, and then he asked him the question, what do you think? And the man was forced to come to the conclusion that he too should show mercy. So there is an art, and I think what we're hearing this weekend is more than just entertainment. It's been very entertaining as well. I enjoyed the stories. Enjoy being with Leroy today some as well. But there's something we can learn because Jesus himself modeled such a good way of communicating truth in a way that was disarming and in a way that made it make sense. So I'm looking forward to what Leroy has to share tonight. But before he comes, let's bow our heads and pray. Father God, thank you for another opportunity to be here together as a body of Christ. Bless all our visitors that came tonight. And Father, I pray for Leroy as he shares stories again this evening. And I pray, Lord, that the truths that are there that you want us to glean tonight would be evident. We could learn some things and maybe even sharpen some of our own skills at learning how to communicate, learning how to present truth and the gospel itself in a way that others can understand. And ultimately, Lord, we want to follow the model of Jesus. So thank you so much again for the opportunity tonight. Would you be here with us in Jesus' name? Amen. Leroy, I turn it over to you.
It's good to see all of you here this evening. I had a wonderful day. Started out with breakfast at the Corner Cafe, and then I went to see my cousin, who's a year older than me, Marie Miller. She's a widow. Her husband died a little over 2 years ago. He was an Amish bishop over close to LaGrange, and they had 9 children. So I spent a couple of hours with Marie and the children, and I told them the story of our grandfather, the children's great-grandfather, and they had never heard that before. So I was quite pleased to introduce them to an important man in their background. You got to be playful sometimes. And other times you have to be serious when you're telling a story. But and sometimes we overthink things and we try too hard to get a sophisticated answer when a simple one is in order. There was a time when Sherlock Holmes and his friend, Dr. Watson, They just finished a big, hard case. They'd figured it out, you know, and they needed a break. And so they packed up and went camping. And they took all kinds of stuff along because they were Englishmen and you do things properly. They had tea kettles and they had pans and they had a big old tent and their pith helmets and whatnot all. And they had a fine day. They set up. They had a lovely evening. They drank their tea. And then they turned in. And in the middle of the night, Sherlock woke up. And something was strange. And so he elbowed Watson and said, "Watson, wake up.
What do you want?"
"Well, look up." Watson kind of looked up. Sherlock says, "What do you see?" And Watson said, "Well, I see stars." Sherlock said, "Well, what does that mean?" And Watson's kind of gathering his wits, you know, and it's like, "Well, astrologically, it means the sun is in Leo. And astronomically, there's billions and billions of stars in the sky and lots of galaxies. Meteorologically, it looks like it's going to be a sunny day tomorrow. And theologically, God's in heaven and everything's all right with the world." And then he thought and he said, well, Sherlock, what do you think it means?" And Sherlock said, "You dummy, somebody just stole the tent right off us while we were sleeping." So there you have it. Don't overthink it. My Aunt Ida was a serious, melancholy, reflective person. She was 3 years younger than my mom. And my earliest memories include her. And it was a scene on a Sunday afternoon at my grandparents' house, and we had come back from New Glarus to visit. And I was approximately 3 years old. And I knew something important was coming down. I could sense it. People were paying attention. You know, it was kind of a sleepy afternoon, but it was towards evening. And Aunt Ida, she had herself all pinned up, and she was nervous, and she was expecting something. And the others were watching, and we were not disappointed. Pretty soon, a little open buggy turned in at the driveway, and off stepped Danny Gingrich. Now, Danny was a wiry little guy. He had black hair, and he had red cheeks, and he wore a poison green shirt. I can still see it, and there's no poison green in here. It's an intense kind of Lincoln green that you only see on Amish window blinds or on their shirts. And he had one of those on because it was an important evening. And he was a nervous but determined young man. And he made his way up the steps and through the screen door. And he was there to pick up Aunt Ida. He'd already asked for their first date. He was taking her to the singing. And we were all watching with great interest. Well, we spent the rest of the evening kind of quietly and went home, and it was not that long that we heard in a letter from Grandma that they were going steady, kind of like engaged. And not long after that, we got an invitation in the mail to come to Danny and Aunt Ida's wedding, and that was really exciting. So we got ready, and we got our stuff in order and a driver, and we showed up and we helped put the whole house together for the reception, and the actual wedding service took place at the neighbor's house. I don't remember the service. You know, you just kind of grinned and bared it when you were 3 years old, but I remember the reception. It was a joyous event, and I remember that Danny and Ida sat in the corner and that there were tables sort of streaming out from their corner along the walls, their best friends sitting there facing each other. And then the middle of the room was filled up with more tables, all made with benches and the little brackets and everything. And the corner was all decorated. They had fancy, you know, those glass bowls with the little stems that come up like this with fruit hanging down over the sides. They had goblets, and somebody had made little, kind of heart-shaped things out of styrofoam and carefully glued the ABCs out of ABC soup and made little letters, Danny and Ida, and the date and everything on there. It was quite fancy. But what I liked is there were little decorative little BBs. They were a little bigger than BBs, and they were white, and they were pressed sugar, and they had kind of a greenish hue to them. And they were sort of strewn around kind of like decoration, and I think you could eat them. I'm not sure. But the boys figured out that it was a wonderful little missile to throw at each other. And so they were like zinging them at each other, and they would hit, you know, and ting off a glass and then bounce on the hardwood floor and go ting, 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 ting. And I remember down on my hands and knees, I was chasing those things, and I was putting them in my pocket to take along home. It was so much fun. There was tapioca pudding, there was date pudding, there was food everywhere, and it was a joyous occasion. We had a wonderful time. And we went home. And it was not long after that that the Mennonites found us. Let me just work on this a little bit. I'll try it. Can you hear? Am I still with you? Good. The Mennonites found us. We were back in New Glarus, and a long black station wagon turned in our little lane and parked there. I was playing out in the yard, and I saw it. And this man got out, and his name was Dean Hostetler, and he was from Muscadet, and he spoke Pennsylvania German. And he was a Kirby vacuum cleaner salesman, and he proceeded to try and sell my mom a Kirby vacuum cleaner. He had all the stuff, and you know, this is better than any other vacuum cleaner, going on, and finally my mom had to announce to him that we didn't have any places to plug those things in, and that he could just save his breath. Well, he was a really good salesman. He was not turned off by that at all. He said, you know what? Up in Muscadet, at our church, we have plug-ins. And you know what? I'd be glad to come early next Sunday morning, pick you guys up, and you could come visit our church, see how you like it. Well, my mom was always up for an adventure. And she just said, sure, why not? Because she'd immediately thought, well, it's the between Sunday. We're not having church anyway. Might as well do that. And so the next Sunday morning, Dean showed up early. And I remember my mom got me all ready for church in the usual way. I had my little black jacket and my little white shirt. And she always strung some Cheerios up on a string and tied them off tight, kind of like a little necklace. And that went on the inside in my jacket pocket here. And then when it's 3 hours of Amish church, you know, and when I just couldn't stand it anymore, I'd pull those out and I just kind of crunch, 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 crunch. And I couldn't spill them all over the floor. And I had my little dogs, my little white dog and my little black dog with the magnet on the bottom of each one. And you would play with those with the owl spoon. You'd put one on one page, one on the other, and you could make them move around. It was like magic. And I had the little square thing with the little tiles that you moved around, and it made a little puzzle of the United States on it. And I could never make it all fit together, but it took a while, you know, it took some time off. It was a way to get through there. I had my little tablet and my little pencil to write things with. We were all ready. And we rode up with Dean Hostetler in his long black car. And I remember walking in there. It was exciting, strange people. They sat in pews with backs on them. And they sang out of the church and Sunday school hymnal, and the edges of the pages were almost red. And they sang four-part harmony. It was beautiful. And we were thinking, wow, this is really nice. And then Roy J. Headings, the bishop, he preached a sermon, and he preached it in English, in just ordinary words everybody could understand. And the sermon was about grace. And maybe my parents didn't understand all those old High German words, and maybe they just missed Gnade and those things when it was mentioned, but they thought it was a most unusual and interesting sermon. They'd always been thinking more about you do what you're told, and you hope for the best, and you're not sure. And it appealed to my parents. And then my dad was already thinking, he was thinking, how much he hated horses and how hard it was to be plowing in a field on those Wisconsin hills right next to one of those English neighbors that had a tractor, and they'd get their field done by 4 o'clock and he still had 5 days to go in his. He hated that. And he was a mechanic, you know. He wasn't a horse guy. So he was thinking, look, these people speak Pennsylvania German. They dress decently. They teach out of the Bible. I could farm with a tractor and I could go to heaven. He was ready to be signed up right there. Took my mom a little longer because she was thinking about all the relatives back in Buchanan. And she knew about Strengmeidung and shunning. And she loved her family, and she didn't want that stress. But the other thing that was going on at that time is that new young church in New Glarus, you know, all those people moved in there, and they brought all their stuff. They brought their horses, they brought their plows, they brought their cows, everything they needed for a new community. They even brought their hymnals and all that stuff. The one thing they didn't bring was a really good system of solving problems. And wouldn't you know, there was a big old problem early on in that church. And they worked on it. But they couldn't figure it out, and the church split right down the middle. Half were on one side, half on the other. And they didn't know how to speak peaceably to each other. And finally, the whole community broke up and everybody moved away except Jay Kramer and his twin sisters. And they still live there. But they aren't doing that well because there's no church there. It's been about 40 years. So my parents were sort of like, you know, our church isn't working well. We could drive tractors and go to heaven. We'll just move over there. Well, it seemed pretty simple until it was time to go back to Buchanan County at Christmas time and be with the families. So we loaded up. We didn't have to hire a driver. We took the old 64 DeSoto, and we drove back there. Well, we didn't get a very warm welcome. And when we left, the uncles were pretty stern, and some of the aunties were crying. And you can't blame them. They thought we were going to hell, and they didn't want that. And it wasn't much fun for my parents. It was just pretty tense. And on the way home, my dad said, you know, I think I could do without this kind of reunion. Why don't we just skip going back for these things? And my mom said, she said, they're our relatives, and we are going to visit them twice a year, whether they like it or not. That's the kind of person she was. And we just went ahead and did that. We'd go back twice a year, and we'd visit everybody. And gradually, we had kind of a somewhat of a peace there, you know. There was certainly still disapproval, but we could visit with each other. And if we were there at one of the relatives' houses over a meal, they would say we could come in and eat. And they'd set up two tables. And we'd sit at one table, they'd sit at the other. Now, the tables usually were right up against each other. So if you didn't really know about it, you could almost think, well, it's just business as usual. But it was ecclesiastical disapproval that they were required to show, and they did that. Everybody, that is, except Aunt Ida and Uncle Denny. You see, Uncle Denny was in the lot, and he was ordained to be a deacon. It happened to those Gingriches more often than not. We thought it was God's punishment on them for being such rowdy creatures. Then they had to be good examples, and it was hard. You could tell it was hard. Like they'd be being all good and straight, and then they just, you know, and try to do some prank on somebody. And then they have to like, oh, no, no, I'm a deacon. I can't do that. We kind of enjoyed that, seeing that kind of stress, you know. It was like God working in their lives, and it was about time. Well, I guess Denny thought he needed to be a good example, and Ida, being the person she was very concerned, and they kept us at arm's length. We'd come to their place, and we were never invited in to eat. And they were very grim, and they were kind of, you should really change your ways. Not that inviting. And so, you know, we just never got very close to them. They decided a couple of years into this that Buchanan County was getting too liberal, and they moved up to Augusta, Wisconsin, way up there, far away from the world and all of those drifting influences, and that's where they raised their family. And we tried to visit them there about twice. My mom would write a letter, and we'd show up, and nobody'd be home. And we'd track them down. We'd follow the buggy tracks. We were good at that. And we'd ask the neighbors, and we'd find them all the way over on the other side of the community. And they were doing, oh, we needed to help so-and-so do spring cleaning. And it was like July or something. We knew. We got the message. And we just didn't go see them much anymore. But we did keep up with them. My mom did, by reading the budget. And some of you know this, that the budget is the most successful newspaper in the United States. It's the fattest, biggest newspaper, I think, that's published. It has over 100 pages in it. And it is just full of news. And my mom gets that. She looks forward to that every week, and she reads it from the beginning to the end, every one of those articles. She knows everybody. A lot of people she hasn't ever met, she knows who they are. And if she ever meets them, it's like old friends. It's kind of like Amish Facebook. That's how we kept up with Aunt Ida and Uncle Denny. We read in there that they finally were able to buy a farm. They were renting. And then they had bad luck. Their cows came down with chronic wasting disease. And it was just hard work up there, is what it sounded like. And they had a little band mill, and they milled out some lumber to make some buildings. And one by one, the children, you know, grew up, and they had weddings. Of course, we were never invited. I got to know 88 of the 100 cousins quite well. But those 12 up there in Augusta, we just didn't know them, except what we read in the budget. We read one time that David was out hunting deer, and he was up in a tree stand of some kind, fell asleep, woke up on the way down, and he broke his ankle and his elbow, and he slashed himself with a broadhead. He was bow hunting, broke some ribs, and he did not show up. And at about 10 o'clock, his wife sent the neighbors to look for him. Nobody knew where he was exactly. They finally found him. He was dragging himself home, inch at a time, in great pain. Fell 40 feet. They went and measured. Well, that was in the budget. And in the budget, writers will comment about each other and to each other. Well, my Uncle David out in Montana, he noted in his letter the following week He said, I see that nephew David in Augusta fell while he was hunting whitetail. And he just said, I want you to know, David, you could come out here and hunt in Montana. And you know, out here, you don't have to climb up to the top of trees. Our deer just walk around right on the ground where you can get them. It's safer. That's the kind of thing that went on in the budget. But you got to read it each week, otherwise you don't get the joke. It's kind of about timing. We read that Uncle Danny was sick, and he went to the hospital, had prostate cancer, and that stuff didn't go right, and he was not very well at all. And then we read something about somebody wanting to buy Uncle Danny and Aunt Ida's farm, and they're offering a lot of money, but it was kind of vague. That's what we knew, and it was all from reading in the budget. Well, the only time we would ever see Uncle Danny and Aunt Ida and the cousins in a place where, you know, there wasn't tension would be at a funeral. And that's because God decides when the funerals are, nobody else, and everyone's invited. You can't tell people not to come to a funeral because that's a lesson about mortality. And did we ever get a lesson? In 2012, in June, Uncle John's son, Harley, died of cancer. He was 44 years old, and he left Frida, his wife, and 9 children, and they were from about 18 down to about 3 years old. It was really sad. Everybody came round, and they came to that funeral. I mean, a lot of people. And remember, these Amish, they don't have electricity. So you can't have everybody in one space because you can't talk that loud without a loudspeaker. So we sat, the cousins and the aunts and uncles, we all sat in the new machine shed, and they had the house completely full, and there were other ministers there preaching, and there was a circus tent kind of thing in the backyard, and there was a whole nother service going on there. And when it was time, everybody filed past the casket, of course. There were over 1,200 people there. I remember sitting there, and Joseph Wagler was the minister. And he got up, and he preached, and he said, he looked right at Frida and said, Frida, don't second guess what you did. It's easy to do that. You did the best you could. They'd gone down to Tijuana to try and treat the cancer, and they got a lot of criticism for that. He said, the lesson here is turn your face towards eternity and prepare for your end, because we're all going to end up dying. Well, we filed past that casket, and then we loaded him up. We took him down to the cemetery, and we buried him. And then we came back, and the Bloomfield Amish ladies fed every one of us a late lunch. And I noticed at some point that Uncle Danny and Aunt Ida were there among the mourners. They'd come all the way down from Augusta, Wisconsin. And I wanted to talk with Danny. And so I saw him head toward the food place there, and they were handing out trays as fast as people came up there. And I made so I was right there, got mine right behind his, and as we walked out, I got kind of even with him and said, hello, Uncle Danny. And he looked at me, yeah, Leroy, and started talking. I said, I heard that you had a fantastic offer for your farm. And he said, yeah. Yeah, that's true. I said, how much was it? Well, the guy came out, said he'd give us $15 million for the farm. Wow, how'd that work? Well, he said, we had a well drilled, and the well driller saw we had special sand 35 feet down under our farm. He said, most sand is pointy and sharp, and our sand was nice and round like the tiniest little BBs. I said, oh, well, that's interesting. What does that matter? Well, he said, it's very rare And he said, I looked it up in the World Book Encyclopedia, and this kind of sand, the encyclopedia says there was a glacier, ice, that moved down from Canada, and it rolled sandstone ahead of it for hundreds of miles and worked all the sharp edges off until it was just this nice round stuff. And apparently the glacier stopped right by my farm, and it started melting back again, and it left an esker of this wonderful round sand right under my farm, and then, you know, it silted up and everything. And that sand is used when people drill horizontal wells for oil in shale, and they drill down there, and then they put dynamite down, and I was really paying attention when the dynamite came up. They know just where it is, and they put explosions in there. It blows holes in the casing and makes cracks into the shale where the oil is. And then they mix up gelatin and water and this round sand, and they pump it down there at high pressure, and it squishes out into the cracks and keeps them all pried open, and the crude oil can ooze in past all those nice round sands, and then it gets pumped up. And if you use just regular sharp sand, it would pack in there too tight, and the oil would just plug up and it couldn't come out. So people pay good money for that round sand, what I've got down there. Wow, that's interesting. Well, what did you do? Well, you know I'm not well, and I might not live very long, and I knew I could never spend $15 million on my own. So I called all my children home, all our children, all 12 of them, and we had a family council. Well, what did you decide? Well, we talked about it. And I found out what one of the girl cousins said. She said, I don't know what everyone said, she said when it was her turn to talk, she said, you know, every Monday morning I make a list for my husband when he goes to town, all the stuff I need. And so far we've had enough money to always get everything on my list. So I guess we really don't need any more money. I thought, wow, that's pretty smart, and she only went through eighth grade. And he said, we went around, we talked quite a while about this. And the main thing we decided is, if we got that money, none of us would have to work again, ever. And we decided that would be bad for our spiritual life. I thought, wow, he's smarter than I thought for a grumpy old deacon. And I said, well, what happened when the guy came back? It was an agent from one of the oil companies to see what they decided. And he said, well, he came back, all right. I wanted to know what we decided. And I said, no, we're not going to sell. And he said, well, what happened to him? Well, he said, his mouth kind of dropped open. And then he got a gleam in his eye and he said, oh, well, how about $17 million then? He thought I was holding out for more money. And I had to tell him, no, that would be even worse. And he just had to leave because we were not selling. Wow, I was really impressed with that little story. And I had a whole bunch more questions, but just then, Jonathan, age 10, and Maria, age 11, and Jason, age 15, came over. They were the children of the bereaved. And they said, Leroy, we want a story. We want Taillebone. Can you tell us Taillebone now? And I looked at them and I said, we just buried your dad. It wouldn't be reverent, it just wouldn't be, to tell a story like that right after we bury your dad. And they said, today's the saddest day of our life. We want something to be happy about. Just tell us any story then. And you can't tell people like that no, you know, because it was the saddest day of their life. And I said, okay, in 10 minutes, I'll tell you some stories. I'll get my wits together, and you gather your friends, and you go over by the maple trees in the front yard there. And they said, all right, and they were gone. Well, I had to gather my wits, so I got over there and I found a couple of stories somewhere way back in the back of my head that were kind of fit for at a funeral. And they were there, and they wanted stories, and I told them this story, and I told them that story, and they wanted more. And all their friends were gathered around, packed around, and pretty soon I saw there were some big people around the edge, too. They were listening to the stories, and more of them, and I was kind of like, you almost feel nervous, you know, kind of packed in there. And then I saw Aunt Ida. And she was trying to see what was going on. And she was walking along the edge kind of out here and kind of looking in here. And I raised my voice because I wanted her to hear my story. Because how often do you get to talk to Aunt Ida? And then I saw my mom, and she was trailing Aunt Ida. Came right over and stood right beside her. And all of a sudden, Aunt Ida turned over, and she saw my mom. She looked her up and down, and she said something. And then my mom, you know, and they talked a little bit there. And I was telling the story really loud, and I couldn't see what it was. And later on, I asked my mom, what was going on there? And she said, well, you know, I wanted to talk with Ida. And I was over there, and she turned, looked me up and down, and she said, why are you wearing such a long dress? If Mom would have made you wear a dress that long when we were in the youth group, you would have had a fit. You know, it's kind of like the princess thing, you know, where you wear the long dress. It's the style, kind of. And so all the dresses get a little longer. You would never wear dresses as long as we do now if you had to milk cows by hand, because you'd have cow on the bottom of your dress. And you're not much of a princess when you have cow on the bottom of your dress. My mom did not know what to say. She finally said, well, I guess I'm repenting for all my sins. You know, just what comes out of your mouth, what do you know? Oh, and then she said, where did Leroy learn to tell stories like that? And she, again, Kat got her tongue. That's really rare for my mom. And before she could say anything, Ida said, I know. He went to school to learn to tell stories, didn't he? And my mom was like, well, yeah, that's what he did. And then she said the most amazing thing we'd ever imagined. She said, I want my children to hear that story about the wise shoemaker. If I invited you and Leroy up for supper sometime, and then had all my children come home afterwards, would he tell that story to us? It was amazing. And my mom got her voice back, and she turned into my agent, and she was right there. She said, well, of course he would. And she knows how to finish a deal. She said the second weekend in October would be perfect. We'd have all the garden stuff in. And how about Friday night? And before Aunt Ida could change her mind, we had a date. And that's how we found ourselves in the little Odyssey minivan. My mom and me and my dad driving all the way from the middle of Kansas, all the way through Iowa, and all the way up to northern Wisconsin, almost to Duluth. We got there a couple hours early on the appointed day. And Aunt Ida met us outside and said, would you like to go on a walk before we eat supper? And we said, sure. My mom and I did. My dad was tired. He wanted to poke around in the barn and see what was going on there and in the shop. You know, some people like that. Aunt Ida and my mom and I walked back over the hill and down into the pasture where the heifers were nipping off the grass. And it was that one of those October evenings when it's kind of cool. And it was clear, golden light from the sun, and it made everything almost ethereal. It was just beautiful. And it was a beautiful farm. And we walked up along the pasture where the percherons were lined up, and they all wanted, you know, like to nuzzle around and be scruffed a little bit, big velvety noses. And we meandered back, and we saw the place where they drilled the well for the water, and where they'd found the sand. And I remember I got us a handful out, and it was not easy to see. it kind of mixed, some round sand, some square sand, but yeah, it was sand, and I could imagine it looked round. And we headed back finally and got into the yard, and I saw this maple tree. And it was about this big, and it grew up here, and the lowest branches, they came out of the tree, and they'd been trained to come around like this. And they were growing right back into the trunk down here. And I said, Aunt Ida, what's that all about? Oh, she said, that was Danny. You know, when he went in the last time for that cancer surgery and stuff was not looking good, and he was really weak, he was thinking he might not come back from the hospital alive. And he went out and he monkeyed around, drilled some holes and trimmed and put that stuff in there so it would grow that way. And he told me, he said, if I don't come back, you could come out once in a while, look at that tree, and you could remember me. He's sentimental that way. And we moved on, and we came into the porch there where the pump was, and there was Danny, and he was washing his hands. And I said, Danny, you have a beautiful farm, but why not just sell the farm and have all that money and just go buy another farm? Well, he said, I scrimped and saved for this farm, and there were three things I wanted. I wanted hardwood trees, I wanted hills, and I wanted a trout stream. And this farm has hardwood hills, and it has hardwood trees, and it has hills. It doesn't have a trout stream, but I got a bulldozer in, and we dug a pond, and there's some nice bass in there. So I like my farm. And you know, if they would have taken my farm, they would have turned it into a strip mine. And they would have bulldozed the hills out, and they'd have bulldozed the trees out, and all the wildlife would be gone. And I like the wildlife. I like those white-tailed deer, and I like going out listening to the birds. And all those little wild animals, they'd have all been chased out of here. My children live in a circle around me here. I'm right in the middle. There wouldn't be a better farm for me anywhere. So this is a good farm. And the other thing is, if they did that, they'd be mining day and night around the clock on Sundays. And the neighbors would be really annoyed because there'd be dust and clanking and lights and it wouldn't be good for the community here. I live right in the middle. You know, there's Amish farms all around me here. And the last thing he said is, I want to do what's right. I'm the deacon. People expect me to be a good example. And there are things that are more important than money. I was really impressed. I thought, wow, you know, this sounds like somebody who's actually thought about things and who's actually read the Bible and took it seriously. Well, we went on in and we sat down for supper and it was Amish comfort food. It was wonderful. It was smooth and it was sweet, just like my dad likes it. There was tapioca pudding, and there was date pudding, too. There was chicken noodle, and there were mashed potatoes. And you just put that chicken noodle right on there. It was good. Almost as good as food we had at Reinhilde and Ira's tonight. We had homemade bread. It was fresh. And I'm telling you, it's the kind, you know, where the yeast works a little faster than Ida always expected it. And my grandma made this kind of bread too, and it would come up and sort of spread out over the edges. And then when you sliced it, it looked like elephant ears, that kind of slices. They were so good, you know, because there's a lot of kind of crust around there like that with butter. Mwah. It was wonderful. Now, oh, and we had for dessert, we had angel food cake with real cream and strawberries. It was wonderful. It was a feast of love. Now, I will point out that we did sit at separate tables. Danny, Ida, and their daughter sat over here, and they had their tables about 18 inches apart, and then my mom and my dad and me sat here. But there was love, and there was kindness in that food, in that supper. And there was gentleness, and there was welcome in the conversation we had. And it reached all the way, those 18 inches back and forth, over the gap between our tables. It was a beautiful feast. Well, it wasn't long until we heard buggies crunching through the gravel, and it was dark already by then. And those 12 cousins that I didn't know started piling out with their spouses and their children. There were a lot of people. We set up benches and chairs all the way around the edge of the living room, dining room, kitchen, kind of all the way over here. They had 3 5-gallon buckets of popcorn. We ate 2 of them, and we strewed one all over the hardwood floor. The children were kind of playing over here with the toys, and then Aunt Ida got up and said, "This is your cousin Leroy, and he's going to tell us some stories that I want you to hear." And she sat down, and there I was. And so I proceeded to tell some stories. And I was telling stories, and they were listening, but there was this one little boy. He was about this tall. His name was Jonathan, I found out. And he had black hair, and he had red cheeks, and he was wiry, and he had dark eyes. And when he wanted something, he was on it, and you could not change his mind. And he wanted a red rubber ball that one of his girl cousins had there, and she was twice as big as he was. All of a sudden, we heard a girl gagging. And I looked over there, and he had her by the covering strings, and he was proceeding to throttle her to get the ball away. And one of the adults nearby just kind of reached over and peeled his little fingers off and moved him over and just redirected him. And by the way they did it, I could tell that that was a common occurrence. I kept my eye on Jonathan. He had on a dress, and it was poison green. It's hard to miss him. And he was here, and he was there, and he was all over, and he was over into my juggling stuff, and finally I just scooped him up, held him like this, and told my stories with this hand only. And he liked that because he was kind of in the center there for a while. And eventually, you know, we kept on going, finished the stories, and we visited and caught up a little bit and figured out a little bit who was who. But it was too many people, and they didn't have one of those photo, you know, directories like you do. It was not as convenient. And they left again because they had to get up early to milk cows the next morning. And as they were going, Uncle Danny said, "Leroy, I want to show you something." And he took me over by the cook stove in the kitchen, and near it there on the wall, he opened what looked like just a beautiful built-in cupboard, you know, all nicely fitted, opened the doors, and there were some shelves here, and down here it was just a huge, beautiful stack of firewood cut perfectly and split perfectly for the wood stove. And I was like, "Well, that's nice." And then I saw, "Oh, that's kind of interesting. The wood box kind of had a handle, and there was a towing strap, and it went up here, and there was a wooden pulley and a big old lag screw, and the strap went over here, another pulley, and then it just went right down into the basement." And I was like, "Well, what's this?" And he said, "Well, when we did a little remodeling, I decided to just cut a hole between the floor joists. And then I made this nice thing here, looks like a cabinet, you know. And then I have the wood, you know, the boys bring the wood and dump it into the other end in the basement. And I can't carry it upstairs anymore because I'm just too weak. And it gets tracks dirt and everything around. I decided, I just designed this stuff, and I made this wood box. It has little wheels on it, and I can lower it with a crank down in the basement. And then I can drive it over, and I can fill it up and drive it back and hook on and crank it right up in here. And then Aunt Ida can open it and get out her wood until she's done, and I can do it again. I said, wow, that's really nice. How did you figure that out? And he said, by trial and error. Oh, well, tell me more. And he said, well, the first time I made it and I got it all fit just right, and then I loaded it up full to test it, and I cranked, and I cranked, and I came all the way up until it was just about through the floor, and then it stuck. And I think what happened is I made it too precise, and that load of wood made it flex a little bit, and it got a little fat, and it wouldn't fit. And I thought I would just force it, and I cranked hard. And apparently, I didn't use long enough screws in the handle, because they pulled right out, and that whole load of wood fell all the way from the ceiling down to the floor with a horrible crash. And it totaled the wood box. The wheels broke. Pieces flew everywhere. There's a big cloud of dust and a lot of racket. Well, what did you do then? Well, I thought, since I'm down here anyway, I'll just lie down by the wood here and hold real still. What happened then? Well, you know, Ida was up in the kitchen working on some dough, and she heard that all, and she was real quiet for a little bit, and then she said, Denny. And I didn't say anything. And then she said, Denny. And I still didn't say anything. And then she came over and she looked down the hole there to see what went on. And she saw me lying there with some wood all around me. What'd she say then? Well, she said, Denny, if you're not hurt, get up here right now. I couldn't believe my ears. The deacon. And I could tell from that story that that was not the first time he'd pulled one of those things on her. So he said, you know, I made a new one and I made it a little smaller. And it worked pretty well, and there it is. Well, we slept upstairs that night, and it was beautiful. It was so quiet, you could hear the ticking of the grandfather clock downstairs in the living room. And it was dark. No little LED lights, nothing. Just beautiful, dark, and quiet. We slept well. And early the next morning, Aunt Ida was making pancakes for us. And she made pancakes just the way God intended. A little extra oil so the edges are crispy. And she used whole wheat flour. I mean, who would have thunk it? And she had fresh maple syrup. And she had peanut butter, chunky peanut butter, exactly the way you eat, you know, if you have your choices, that's how you eat. And we had coffee, and we had a wonderful little visit, and it was time to go, and she gave my mom a 12 apostles flower, a plant, and it had a pedigree that went all the way back to her great Aunt Ida in Plain City. So it was a gift of love, and my mom treasures it. And she's made slips off of that, and all of my sisters have slips from that plant, and she has it, two or three or four of them, going in our house now. And we loaded that up, we said goodbye, and we headed down County Road R, down towards La Crosse, and on towards I-35, and down to Iowa, and that long way back to Kansas. And for a long time, we didn't say anything. We just drove in silence, the three of us. And I was thinking about Uncle Denny, the trickster deacon. And Dad was over there in the passenger seat, and he was moaning a little bit, and he was like, tapioca pudding. That's his favorite thing, smooth and white, sugary. And Mom was in the back seat, and she was going on. She counts. And she was saying, she was counting back there. She always counts. She can't help it. It's just the way she came out. She counts ancestors. She counts anniversaries. She knows everybody's birthday. She knows all the grandchildren and your grandchildren, too. And she was saying 49. She was saying 49. And finally I was like, Mom, what's going on back there? What's with 49? And she said, it's been 49 years since we've been invited to eat a meal at my sister Ida's house. It was when they were married. That was the last time. Their wedding meals when we were invited. Forty-nine years is almost a lifetime for me. I am so grateful that I live to see Mom and Aunt Ida share a meal of peace and reconciliation together. Now, we're not bosom buddies. They're still Amish, and they still disapprove of our worldliness. But we do it with civility now. And we appreciate each other because we know we're not going to live very long anymore. And so I'm very content with that peace that we have, our families have. And I am so pleased to know this other side of Uncle Denny, the one who loves beauty and the one who lives virtue. And he even has a wicked sense of humor. Makes me so happy to have relatives like that. And I'm so glad I could share that with you as well. I found out that there's a Gingrich thing, and not all of them have it, but you gotta watch it if they're Gingriches. And usually the wiry ones with the black hair and the red cheeks are the ones you gotta watch. And they have this thing where they can't really focus very well, and they're always seeing a place to do a practical joke. So if you know any Gingriches like that, keep your eyes open, because you might get shocked, or, you know, it'll hurt. That's what a practical joke means. It means there's pain involved. I found out, did some research, and I found out that it really runs in Denny's family. And I found out that there was this old man called Rudy Gingrich who lived in Buchanan County still, and that he was Danny's uncle, and he was still alive, and he was somebody my dad really liked when he was a young boy. And so I went to see. I drove specially to visit with Rudy Gingrich, and I found him there sitting in his kind of sun porch, and he was in his 90s at that time. And I said, I really wanna go see your little workshop. And he said, sure, just go out back. It's there, it's unlocked. And I went and had a good look around, because I had found out that Rudy Gingrich, he was a character. He was like one of those Gingriches you gotta watch out for. And the story was, when he was about 3 months old, his family moved from Kelowna, Iowa up to start the community in Buchanan County. Kelowna was getting too liberal, and so the dad and the older brothers and little baby Rudy all loaded up in wagons, and they chased their cows and their pigs along beside, and it took them quite a few days to get up there. And when they got there, the little farm they purchased had basically a claim shanty on it, and the whole family lived in there that first winter. And they had a little tiny loft, and there was this little steep stairs that went up to it. And the children, like all seven of them, slept all in a row in the loft. And there was two rooms in the bottom. There was the kind of the kitchen living area where you ate. And then there was the bedroom. And the bedroom was just big enough for a double bed, and you could kind of walk around two sides of it. That was the entire house. Well, after that next summer, they were able to build a little bigger house and move into it. And then the little house became the shop. And it became Rudy's shop because he loved small engines, and he figured out how to make them work. And people would bring their engines to him whenever they didn't work. And he told me, first thing you always do is you check the gas tank, because half the time, people forget to put gas in. And they pull and pull and pull, and it doesn't work. And then they bring it to me, and I say, well, put some gas in it. Or they put water in the gas tank. And of course, that doesn't work. Or if it's a real big problem, you have to file the points and adjust them, and then they work. I knew how to do all that stuff, so people would bring their things to me to fix. And not just that, people would come by, and they'd sit around in Rudy's little shop on a cold winter day because it was warm in there. They left the potbelly stove there, and it was always nice and warm, and there was this big armchair there, wooden armchair, and people would kind of see who could get there first, sit in the armchair, and you put your feet up on the fender of the stove and stay nice and warm on a cold day. And you could watch Rudy work, and you could listen to him talk, and you could tell jokes, and maybe your friends would come by. Well, Rudy got to thinking that it was getting a little boring around there, and he had some equipment, so he started out, he put 16-penny nails into that wooden chair, about this far apart, right in the middle where you sit, and he hooked up some bell wire to the bottom where they stuck through, and it just kind of moved them over along the wainscot on the wall over here, and by his workbench, by the vise, he had a little push button, he wired the... And then he had a 6-volt battery, and he had one of those Model T Ford coils. And he had that all rigged up here, and he was smart. He knew how to rig that all together, and when you push the button, the little coil would go bzzz, and the electricity would go bzzz through the wires right up those two spikes. And they were flush, so you didn't really notice them. And to make sure, he threw an old, worn-out buggy robe over the whole thing. Well, you didn't know if it would work or not, but it didn't take long to figure it out, you know. Somebody, young guy came in there, and nobody was in the chair. He sat right down, put his feet up, and after he was good and settled in, chatting there, and Rudy was working over here, he just reached over and gave that gut button a good push. And it worked. It went bzzzt, and that little Amishman flew up in the air with a huge noise, and looked around to see what in the world had happened. And then he saw Rudy over there with twinkles in his eyes laughing at him. And he didn't know how, but he knew who was responsible. And he said, "Dwalding." And then he straightened up and zipped his lip and waited for the next person. Because it wouldn't do to be the only one who got shocked. You would be the laughing stock of the youth group. It didn't take long. The next little Amishman came in there, sat down in there, never thought about why it was empty. And they got him. Same thing, up in the air with a howl. Until just about everybody got shocked. And they were smart, these boys were. You get shocked once and you don't sit in that chair again. Because you know he'll do it again. You know he will. And so they would lean against the air compressor, or they'd sit on the bottom step over here of that little steep ladder, or wherever they could, but you didn't sit on the chair. You just knew that. Well, Rudy was like, you know, I've got more tricks up my sleeve. He put a couple of nails into the bottom step of that stair. And my Uncle Mervyn was out hunting foxes, and it was a cold day. He had one of those big overcoats on, and he had fixed his lunch. He'd wrapped up a bologna sandwich in wax paper in here, and he had a little thermos, and he had hot coffee in there, and he had a bunch of cookies, too. And he and his friend, Lester Detweiler, had been fox hunting, and they came in there, and they knew not to sit on the chair. They could sit tight, side by side, on the bottom step of that steps going up there. And they got themselves all rigged up, and they opened their sandwiches, poured their coffee. And Mervyn says he was just ready to get a sip of coffee when Rudy hit the button. And he said, my legs went straight out. And the coffee spilled all over, and the bologna went on the floor, and it ruined everything. He really got us that time. We were not expecting it. Well, they gathered themselves together, and they acted like nothing had happened. until the next people came and got them all again so nobody would sit there. Well, what do you do next? You know, it was a game, and Rudy was up for it. He ran a wire over to the little latch on the door. And he'd get them when they were opening the door to come in. You'd think they'd just stay at home, right? But they weren't quite that intelligent. And they also wanted to see what was going on. Get all of them that way. Well, finally, they would get like a little twig or a piece of wood to open the door handle. And then they'd, you know, like, come on in, and, you know, everything was safe. Well, Rudy was like, you know, if you take a condenser out of a little motor, and you run the motor, and you hold the condenser by the wire, you know where it's insulated, you can hold it to the spark plug, and you can charge it up. And you know, you get like 4,000 volts in there. And it's pretty powerful. And they would, you know, they'd wait till somebody get the stick, open the door, and they'd be coming in, and you'd say, here, catch. And you just catch it, right? And it would shock the bejabbers out of them. And he had, and I'd carry on. And, you know, he got them all that way. Well, then he said they'd open the thing, and they'd peek around to see if, and then if all was clear and he didn't have a capacitor, they'd come on in. Well, you know, everybody, it kind of died down, and after a while, you know, nobody was being shocked anymore. And it's cold, right? And we're back in that little extra room where the spare parts were. Rudy had rigged up a little tin funnel, and he drilled a little hole through the wall, a little pipe out there, so he wouldn't have to go out to the outhouse every time, you know, because it was an indoor plumbing, technically, you know, so it was okay. Well, one day he had this inspiration. He ran a wire to that tin funnel. It was very painful. It was the best practical joke he'd thought of up till then. It was almost too much. So he kind of let it all go for a while. And people just kind of got used to, you know, how it was. And he was kind of off to other things. Well, this unusual thing happened. A group of people from back in Kelowna decided they wanted to come visit friends for a day up in Buchanan County, and they hired Tiny with his van to haul him up there. And Tiny was an ironic nickname because Tiny was actually a large man. He really liked Amish cooking, and all he ever did was drive that van. And so they told him, hey, Tiny, you know, we want to go home about 8 o'clock tonight. You just go do whatever you want and just come back at 8. Well, it was cold, and Tiny didn't want to run the van, waste the gas. He drove around a little bit, and then he saw smoke coming out of that little shop, and he saw the little sign, motors fixed, and he thought, well, he'll just sit in there and enjoy himself while maybe get a snooze in. So he went in, and Rudy was in there working, and he saw that nice armchair with the old buggy robe on it, and he just settled himself right in there, fit nice and snug. And chatted just a little bit with Rudy, and there was Rudy, and he was working away, and he was thinking, would you shock an English or not? I mean, you know, Amish, no question. But an English, would you shock an English? And finally he decided, well, you wouldn't know unless you tried. And he just went ahead, and after a while, he just pushed that button good and hard, and the battery was still up. And it buzzed, and the electricity flowed. And Pinky was, or Tiny, he was just kind of settled down and just about fallen asleep. He was so unsuspecting. And when that electricity hit him, he came alive. And it was almost a miracle. He floated up out of that chair. And he hung in the air a couple of feet above it for some time. Miracle kind of wore off, and he headed back down. And as he went down, he picked up speed. And when he got back down to the chair, he didn't stop there. The chair parted, kind of like Moses in the Red Sea. And Tiny went right on down until he was firmly anchored on the concrete floor. And he was very unhappy, I have to say. And it took quite a few pieces of pecan pie to calm him down. But that was the end of the Amish electric chair. No more shocking on that one. But I did see the old stove, and I saw some of the wires, and I saw the button. And I'd gotten most of this information from my dad, who learned mechanics from Rudy Gingrich, because he was their neighbor. And so I went on in and I chatted with Rudy a while about how things were. He said, I like to sit here and get some sun, and I watch the school children come and go over at the schoolhouse. And finally I said, hey, Rudy, I heard that you used to shock people with your, you know, like Model T Ford coil and all that. And he's this saintly old man, sweet, you know, and everything. And he, this is what he did. He just got kind of a twinkle in his eye, and he said, well, could be that I might have shocked somebody once or twice. And then he kind of wanted to change the subject. I guess it wasn't, you know, he'd kind of grown past that or something. Anyway, it's time to go home, but at least now you know what to look out for. And so if there's Gingriches around, and they've got the red cheeks and that wiry and the dark hair, look out. They will do stuff to you when you're not looking, and it will hurt. And I'm just warning you. It's my job here. I have a last little thing here. I want to give you just about 1 minute or 2 minutes worth of shop tips on how to tell stories. You know, what makes just something that happens into a story? Well, there's a number of things. One is you look closely and you notice. You notice how people talk. And if something is really pleasing, you try to do that again, like they did it. And so if you're quoting them, you can do it like they do. Use active verbs. That makes the story move along a little better. Use what I call the progressive present. Think of yourself as narrating a story to people, and you can't see it, but I can see it right here, and as I'm watching the story here, I'm explaining to you what's happening as we go in the present perfect tense, not in past tense, and it makes it feel like you're looking at it yourself here. That's one of the little techniques to make things move along. Don't try to memorize your stories word for word. What you want to do is memorize them scene by scene, kind of like a comic book, you know, where you've got this scene and the next, and it makes a story. And then think about that story and describe it in whatever words happen to come to you at the time. And be sure to use all your senses. How does it taste? Always put stuff in your mouth. That's my policy. Ever since I was a baby. See what it tastes like. What does it look like? How does it feel? What does it sound like? All those things help make a story a story. Be specific. Name things. Zero right in and talk about one thing, but make sure that specific thing is not distracting. We don't want to know whether it was 1971 or 1972. We want to know where it hurt and what color it was and how it gnashed its teeth when it got its tail stepped on. That's what we want to know. So focus on the details that are relevant to your story. You're the tour guide. Make sure it's interesting. And this is what I have to tell myself over and over again. Speak up and slow down so that the old people who forgot their hearing aids can understand you. Let your storytelling break the fourth wall. When you're doing acting, there's the wall, the wall, the wall, the three walls. There's an invisible fourth wall right here. I feel kind of like I'm separated from you. So if I step through this wall and I don't trip and fall, I've suddenly done something that is weird. And you're just like, wait a minute, that's not right. What's he doing over here? And is this safe? And it shouldn't be allowed. And suddenly you're like, what's he going to do now? I've broken through the fourth wall. And I think I should have done it sooner because it feels too much like I'm preaching when I'm up here. And here now, I'm with you. I'm just telling you stories, right? So that's my little group of tips. And I hope you can all use them to good effect. Remember, they're tools. And you can use tools that are strong, good tools. I have a toolbox in my shop back at home. It's higher than my head. It has drawers for everything, and they're all packed full. Wonderful tools. I can do all kinds of things with those. I can build great, wonderful things. I could make bombs. I know how to make bombs. I could. IEDs. I'd be dangerous if I was a Gingrich. I would be. Storytelling is tools. So it doesn't just, it's not good enough to have tools. You got to use them to do good things. And for us, it is building the church and building the kingdom of God. And we do that not just seriously, but we do it with a gleam in our eye, with a twinkle. And we do it with pleasure. And we draw people. We want people to want what we have. So live that way. That's the best I can say for you tonight. Thank you for listening to me. Does anybody have questions or comments? Right over there. Do you want a mic so everybody can hear you? This one right here, the one that's engaged to be married, right? Yeah, excellent. What is it?
I'm a little bit like those children at the funeral. I want to hear your tailybone story.
Tailybone. But it's 8:30. Don't we have to go to bed now? I think it's curfew. Oh, should we do it? Tailybone's a crazy story. Do you want tailybone? All right, tailybone it is. There was an old man. He was about my age, and he had a long beard, and he was about, you know, and children would besiege him, and people would ask him, you know, and he always was, you know, in the middle of things. And one day he said, I need peace and rest. And he just struck out to the middle of the section over there where that big grove of trees is, and that little creek goes through there, and he cut down some trees, and he built himself a little log cabin. And it was just about as wide as this aisle is here, and it was about as wide as long, you know, as these two benches, just a little cabin, long enough so that he could lie down longwise along one edge, and he made himself a little bed to sleep. And in the end here, he laid up some rocks and some mud, and he made a little just like a chimney and a fireplace. And he got himself a rebar, and he made a hook that sort of swung in and out here, and he brought down a little kettle with a little chain, and he hooked that on the hook, and he could swing it in over the fire, and he could cook his food right there. And over here, he had a little tiny shelf with a little curtain in front of it, and that was his cabinet. And he had a tin plate, and he had a knife and a fork and a spoon, and that was what he ate with. That's all he needed. He was a bachelor. And he had a little sack of beans here, and he had his .22 rifle, and he had an axe, and over here he had the door. And you could open that door, click, creak, open and close it. And he needed some air, so he cut a little window right here. And he made a shutter, no glass, and he could open that, click, creak, and he could let some air in, or he could close it. And every morning he'd get up after he'd slept good and long. He didn't care how, he didn't even bring his watch along, because he was done with all this running around and having to do stuff all the time. He got up when he wanted to, and he got his .22, and he had two dogs. He had Prince and Charlie. And he'd say, here, Prince, here, Charlie, let's go hunt. And off they'd go, and they'd meander around, and they'd look for something, and they'd go around, and he'd be looking. He'd be thinking about supper, right? Running around, all of a sudden, he'd see a rabbit, and he'd go, kaboom! And he'd shoot it, and he'd take it home, and he'd dress it, and he'd give the scraps to the dog, and he'd put that rabbit in that little iron kettle, and he'd cook it. And he would eat that until he was full. He had salt, too, so it made it better. And he had a little Marie Sharps, too, just to jazz it up. Yeah, because Marie Sharps makes everything better. Well, sometimes he'd go out hunting and he wouldn't find a thing. And one particular day he went out and it had snowed and it was slushy. And he tramped and his dog sniffed and they looked and they didn't find anything to eat. Finally, he went all the way home. He was cold, he was hungry, and he was wet. And he got into that little cabin. Oh, he was glad to get in there. And he stoked up the fire and he took off his wet shoes. And he fixed up a little water, and he got some beans out. Didn't like beans that well, but when you're hungry, beans are good. And he got that little fire boiling there, sat on the floor, and he made the floor out of split logs. And he put them right beside each other and kind of leveled them off best he could. He sat there, and he put his wet stocking feet right up against the fire there. And pretty soon, steam was coming up off of his socks. And when the warmth got in there, his toes stung like fire until the circulation got going in there again. And he was smelling those beans, and they were blubbing, blub, blub, gurgle, gurgle, you know, and he was really hungry because he hadn't eaten all day. Just about ready to dish up and eat when he heard a strange little noise behind him, and it was like, what's going on here? And he just looked over here. He's right here by the fire. He looked over here, and between two logs that didn't fit close together, there was a little animal coming up out of the floor. And he had never seen the like. It had sharp white teeth. It had black ears, and it had red eyes. And his fur was green. And he didn't think twice. He grabbed that axe over here, and he just went, "Chop!" and tried to chop it in half. But he didn't aim right. And that little thing squealed and jumped straight up in the air, right back down through that hole and disappeared. He went over to have a look and he saw, oh my word, he had cut that little thing's tail off. And he picked it up. It was as thick as my thumb. It was about this long. It didn't have any hair on it. And there's quite a bit of meat on it. He gave it a wiggle and he looked at the beans and he looked at the tail. And he looked at the beans, and he looked at, and he just went, oops, and dropped it right into his bean soup. And pretty soon, it was all hot and ready to eat, and he was hungry, remember? Got his tin plate, dumped the whole mess in there, and ate it down just as fast as he could. It's kind of like Mark. That felt better. And as he cleaned up his plate, put it away, he started thinking, what kind of an animal was that? And he couldn't figure it out. He didn't know what it was. And it started working on his imagination. He's thinking, that little thing's running around out there, and I ate its tail. And he got a bellyache thinking about it. And he thought, you know what? I'm just going to stoke the fire a little bit, and I'm going to lie down and sleep it off. I'll be all right in the morning. And he did that. And he lay down, and he was there, and his belly hurt, and he kind of crouched together. couldn't sleep. He's finally just kind of getting sleepy. All of a sudden, he heard a noise at the front door, and he sort of sat up and listened. And it was a screech, 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 screech. It was at his front door. And they heard a little noise, and it went, "Tailybone, Tailybone, I want my Tailybone back again." That little thing, come look for its tail. He did not like that at all in the dark and with a bellyache. And he sat up, and he just went, bam, on the side of the cabin. And he said, "Prince Charlie, sick him." And the dogs heard him. They were around sleeping in their little house. They came around, woof, 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 woof. They chased that little thing out away off into the woods, woof, 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 further and further away until they barely could hear him anymore, woof, 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 until they were all gone. He's like, that's so much better. Yeah, Everything's gone now. And he lay down again, and he tried to sleep. But just to be sure, he jabbed some firewood up against the door because he did not want that little thing to get its way in. And he lay down, and he's falling asleep, and he's kind of rubbing his belly, kind of in a fetal position here. Once again, he heard a noise again. Didn't know how long it had been, but there it was, and this time it was right outside his window by that shutter, and was going screech, screech, screech. And then a little voice again, it's Tailybone, Tailybone, I want my Tailybone back again. Didn't like that at all, and he hit the side of the cabin again. He yelled, Prince Charlie, sick him. And they heard him, and they came back. And they start fighting with that thing right out in front of the cabin. All of a sudden, something went wrong. And it was like... And everything got deathly quiet. And the man was scared to go out in the dark to see what had happened to his dogs. And he just kind of huddled there and moaned and worried and rubbed his sore belly and waited. And he could not sleep. On and on. And finally he's like, you know, it's got to be morning. I'm just going to check. And he just turned up here, and he opened that shutter right by his bed. And he went click, creak, and he looked out. And wouldn't you know, the sun was just coming up. And it looked like a clear, beautiful day was dawning. And he knew that those little creatures like that do not come out during the day. It's only at night. He was so relieved. And remember, he'd barely slept a wink that night. He just lay down on that little bed, and he fell fast asleep. And he did not wake up until noon. And only then, because he heard a screech, 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 and he looked up and rubbed his eyes, and right there on the windowsill, he saw two red eyes glaring down at him, and sharp red teeth, and greenish fur. And before he could do a thing about it, that little animal jumped right down on his belly and started scratching and clawing and biting, and all he could do was grab his pillow, and he started clonk, 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 until the pillow ripped in half, and that little cabin was full of feathers, and fur flew. And there was shrieking and gnashing of teeth. And that is the last anybody ever heard of that man again. And a couple of days later, a freak storm blew in, and lightning struck that cabin and set it on fire, and it burned to the ground. And if you go down there, over there by the trees, over by Little Creek, on a quiet evening, and you walk over there, all you will see are the stones from the chimney and that iron rod in that little pot. And there's a little pile of ash right there. That's all that's left. And people say, if you listen carefully, you will hear a little screech, screech, screech from that ash pile. And a little voice will say, Tailybone, Tailybone, I got my Tailybone back again. There, are you happy now? Thank you for listening to me. Any other questions? Parents? No, children. If you wake up tonight, that little boy back there in the check shirt, if you wake up tonight and you hear outside your window a little screech, 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 you know what to do, right? You go downstairs and you say, Mommy, Daddy, can I sleep in your bed tonight? You know what to do, right? Parents, you have any comments? My sisters tell me, I can't wait until you have children of your own. That's what they say to me. Yeah. after a story like that. Any other questions? Yes, back there. A red squirrel? You think it was a red squirrel. But what about the green fur? It's complicated, yeah. I've heard children talk about this, and they've drawn pictures and sent them to me of that little animal. All painted, I mean, colored in green with the little red eyes and everything. I have a collection of those things. I really like them. I do. Great. It's time to call it a week, isn't it? Could we, is there a song leader? Could we sing like a little doxology parting songy thingy? Could we do that? Who does songs here? I don't. Or what? Let's do that.